This is continuing with Martin Schmidt on 18th August, 75. So in 62, you said you became interested in the Starlight.
Yeah, it was middle 62 that I worked on my first Starlight object, which Tom Matthews had identified and given to me. But of course, before that, late in 1960, 3C48 had been pointed out as a star-like identification of a radio source by Tom Matthews. In fact, at that time, it would have been called a radio star. It was thought to be a star in the galaxy.
Oh, I see. Was that term coming back into vogue at that time?
Oh, yes, briefly? Yes. Oh, yes, yes.
I mean, it's sort of gone out for a while.
It had gone out because since there were no stars at that time that were radio sources, it had gone out. But then with 3C48, it was locally reintroduced again. As you know, 3C48 was found by Matthews and Sandage and Bolton and Munch and Greenstein. Altogether, I happen to be not involved in that at all. Late in 1960, to be a variable star with a blue color, some emission lines, and it was right on the position of the radio source 3C48.
Yeah, what were the error bars in the radio position at that time? Roughly,
I'm not sure. I think it was for that time a rather accurate one, and it's a rather bright source. So let me guess something like. Better than 10 seconds of arc.
I can check that. It would have to be that good, I guess, before you have any confidence.
Between 5 and 10 seconds of arc, I would now guess. Yeah. But I don't know. Can be checked, of course. Somehow that thing had gone by me. Tom had simply been involved with others on that particular thing. And I hadn't given it much attention even when it happened, as can sometimes be the case. I was involved in my galaxies. But when he had another one, 3C286, I observed it in early, I think, 62 or so. And I found that it had one emission line, and I simply couldn't understand what it could be. It was 5170 angstroms, where nothing shows anything, and no object ever shows just a line at 5170 angstroms. And in fact, I wrote a very short letter to the Astrophysical Journal, only this long, only about 3 inches long, a sort of complaining note. It's the first one about quasars, in fact, in August 1962, in which I say that I have this object spectrum, and it doesn't look like anything we have seen before. Because CC48 had not been published yet. It had been at an AES meeting, but the publication was very badly held up until 63.
So you're still thinking, though, in terms of a star, certainly.
Oh, yes, at that time, just thinking of a star. Well, that went on, and Tom soon came up with another such case, which I didn't publish, and which showed no lines at first, 3C196. And Tom came up with another star again, all in the course of the next, you know, one and a half, or next year or so. 3C147, which showed two lines, but these were at different positions, than different wavelength, in the red namely, than the one line for 3C286.
Right.
And then, of course, came in...
Let me just ask.
Late 62,
Did none of these show any wisps or anything? Does 3C48 have a wisp, if my memory correct?
Yeah, 3C48 has a wisp.
Did you notice that at that time?
They had noticed it. It was theirs. That was the one done in 1960, you see, 3C48. Yeah, no, they had noticed that.
But didn't make anything particularly of it?
No, because it's quite difficult to observe. It has only been observed properly only recently at LIG.
But didn't make anything of it as far as what it might mean that it's really not a star?
No. That. At least that I'm not aware of, that they fell that way. By the way, when I say that these other stellar objects came through in 1962, I seem to be getting into some time trouble. It must all have happened mostly in 1962, yes. Because the first spectrum I took of 3C273, for which the position came from both Tom Matthews and from the occultation, observed in Australia,
right,
by the moon, by Hazard and others. I think I observed that thing for the first time very late in 1962, around December 28 or so. And this thing was so bright, it was 12th, 13th magnitude, it was so bright, it completely overexposed the first, even though I widened, I completely overexposed it. Yeah. But I do remember that right at the end of the spectrum, near the atmospheric limit, near 3200, the spectrum seemed to cut off very sharply, and when I looked more, it was totally overexposed, you see, but it cut off very sharply there. When I looked more carefully, there seemed to be a line there. So anyhow, I took other better exposed spectra of it soon, in the next few nights, and these showed up something like five or so emission lines that were all at funny places. None of them had the positions in wavelength of the earlier star-like objects. So it remained totally unclear.
What was the most lines that you had before in any of these objects?
Well, two in 3C147, 204 in 3C147, but all rather close together. I think only two of them finally turned out to be real. One in 3C286. I don't know what they had in 3C48. They already early had quite a few lines, like five or six or so, I think, in 3C48.
So it wasn't unique in that respect?
No. Well, in hindsight, I really treated this thing rather naively, I must say, in the sense that I told everybody. I mean, I came back to Pasadena, I measured the wavelength, and I told everybody that I had this whole slew of lines that I couldn't identify. And I remember that Dr. Bowen, who at the time was director of the observatories, had a hand on it and came up with some very tentative identification with some helium lines. But it didn't look good nonetheless. Dr. Bodo Baschek from Kiel, who was there at the time visiting, made an attempt, and you know, in hindsight it was a bit silly almost to see this thing this way, in telling everybody that you have these five lines and what do they think they are, you know, if you knew what it had been. Yeah. It seemed kind of silly. But anyhow, in the next observing run that he had, Bev Oak worked with his scanner in the farther red that I couldn't easily reach, and found a line at 7600, one single line, strong one. And well, that was added then to the list of lines that people heard about, and there was no really, not any real progress then. And then came there a letter, and that must have been late January or so, 1963, about a month later only, because I'd immediately written Bolton in Australia, who sort of was my contact man with Hazard, whom I didn't know at that time. And he said, Cyril Hazard is going to write the thing up for Nature. Why don't you perhaps write a note that can be published next to it together, so that we can sort of have the whole story in one go. So I thought that might be a good idea, and I think it was on the 5th of February that I sat down, and in the afternoon after lunch on a Tuesday, and I sat down in my office, and I was to write that letter. It could be a very brief one because I didn't understand things. And I do remember that I looked up something on the spectra. I wanted to check something, so I had a bunch next to me, and I looked at them, and then rather suddenly it struck me that there was a certain regularity to the lines. If I left out two of the lines, there were at that moment six lines, I think, and if I took the one red line plus three of the visible ones, but forgot about two of the visible ones, so it wasn't all that right, trivial, then those four that were left seemed to be regularly spaced, decreasing space and going toward the blue and getting fainter and fainter. Now, for some stupid reason, I decided to make an energy level diagram, which in hindsight is totally unwarranted under the circumstances, you see. So, and I computed something, and I must have made an error or so, because things that I then wanted to work out didn't fit at all. Mm-hmm. And I got essentially annoyed and said, but there is regularity, I see it. You see, the error I'd made seemed to say that there was no regularity.
But why do you say that it was not warranted to make an energy level diagram? It seems like it would be the thing that many people would do.
Yeah, well, anyhow, I did it. But what happened then is that I decided, in order to check that things were really regular, I decided to take the ratio of these lines to the neighboring Balmer lines. Mm-hmm. So I took the line in infrared. George, I took the line in the infrared and I took the ratio to H alpha, it's 1.158. And I took the line at 5600 and took its ratio to H beta, and it was 1.159 or so.
Right.
And I looked up and I took the next ratio, it was about 1.158 again. The last one was also something like that.
So the only idea of this was to check the regularity which you thought you saw with your eyes.
That's right.
And that gave you the redshift.
Now that was a shock, of course. So that gave me the redshift. And then in the next few minutes, I checked what the rest wavelength of these other two lines that I'd thrown out would be.
Right.
And the one fitted beautifully with 03, 5007. And the one in the ultraviolet at 3200 fitted very well with magnesium 2 at 2800 angstroms, which had never been seen yet, but which I think I knew that it might be expected. So that seemed a rather positive sort of confirmation of the idea that,
right,
that this was a correct identification. So I sat there for a while, stunned, because a 13th magnitude star doesn't have a 16% redshift, you see.
Right.
I mean, that doesn't happen. And well, I perhaps paced up and down the corridor and I saw Jesse, and I said to him, well, come and listen and look, I mean, you hold on to your seat, you won't believe this. So we melted over for a while, and then Jesse said, after 10 minutes or so, he said, well, why don't we look at the lines of 3C48 again, with that in mind? And it took not more than 2 minutes,
right,
to then get the redshift of 3C48 at 37% or 36% or what it was.
Why had you, do you think you'd not seen it in 3C48 first? Because that data had been around for a while, hadn't it?
Well, A, I had never looked at that, of course.
Well, that wasn't your data. That's
no,
right.
No, that was the other one. That was the first one found. I had never looked at that data, and also it wasn't so obvious in it, because the redshift by that time was so large that things had really shifted a lot, by about 1,000 to 1,200 angstroms, which is quite a lot.
I see.
Well, we again found a 2,800 line then, something that appeared at 3,800 there. We then identified with a 36% redshift as being the 2,800 doublet or line from magnesium 2. Again, which sort of was a mutual reconfirmation of this thing. So things fitted together very well, and we spent the rest of the afternoon essentially checking whether there was any chance that you could get that this could perhaps not be a redshift, but could be some kind of funny ion or so. I mean, we worked that out, and by the next day that was worked out, it couldn't be the case. But things by that time became rather convincing.
Well, you're not worried about a calibration problem
at
any time?
No. I mean, these wavelengths, of course, are very well established, isn't that right?
No.
And the shifts are so loud. Yeah?
No, I mean that your standards had gotten off somehow.
In the spectrogram?
Right.
No.
No chance.
Well, that was that. to cut the story somewhat short, and in order to wind up at 1965, what really happened after that time, as far as I was concerned, was in fact, to my mind, up to 1965, was a more interesting and, as far as I'm concerned, a more satisfying further development than the discovery of the redshift itself was. And that was the extension of the redshifts to very large ones, of the order of two. See, it was clear that if you can have for a 13th magnitude object, a 16% redshift, then for an 18th magnitude object, you should have a redshift of the order of 10 times as much. And therefore, very large redshifts were foreseen on that basis.
It was the Cygnus A thing all over. As soon as you knew you had Cygnus A, you knew that the others were probing.
Yeah, that's true. But here the shifts in wavelength were so enormous that that you now had to base your line identifications, which are always done between, say, 4,000 and 6,000 angstroms in the normal photographic region. You now had to, in order to get very large redshifts like 2, you had to go to a rest wavelength between 1,000 and 2,000 angstroms where no solid information about what line should come up was available at all. And it became sort of a process in which objects were found with increasing redshift such that once in a while such an object would show a line in the far ultraviolet near 32 or 3500 angstroms.
And then you could use it.
Then one could, it was sort of a bootstep as it were, in which you you pull yourself over farther and farther to the ultraviolet by once in a while identifying a line that appears in the ultraviolet for a higher redshift source, and then that line can be used again to get even higher redshift.
Right.
It's easier said than done though to just ask for a higher redshift source, because out of all the star-like objects that Tom Matthews started to produce, one had no idea which ones were the ones to in which order you should work on them. And also these things were very faint in general, of the order of 18th or perhaps somewhat fainter magnitude. At that time, the typical exposure for a spectrum that could be used to get these lines and redshifts was of the order of 5 or 6 hours.
Mm.
So on a typical run to Palomar, I might sometimes, including perhaps not too good luck with the weather once in a while, might often come back with 3 or 4 spectra. And then it was not necessarily an object that you were so interested in, because it might have quite the wrong redshift. It might either be so large that you couldn't, decipher it yet, or it might be so small that it didn't yield any new lines.
Did you make anything of the WISP in 3C48 once you had established that as having a right?
No. It was argued by Matthews and Sandage when they published their paper finally in 1963, taking into account that the redshift was 37%, it was argued by them at that time that the thing was too bright to be a galaxy. But now very recently, of course, it's been shown to be an H2 region, and so it is not a normal sort of galactic light thing. But so that's sort of in a nutshell, I guess, what happened to me from 54 to 65. I've really been most active, I think, in the optical astronomy things, but almost all the time it's been closely tied in with radio astronomy. Right now I'm doing quasar surveys, and I get all my basic information from identified radio sources, really star-like ones.
Let me ask another question. When you had the ratios, it seems like you immediately said, well, that's a redshift, but it might have been something else.
Yeah.
It could have been scattering.
We discussed that at a very early point. When the next day or so we started talking about it locally, our own physicists at Caltech urged us that we should particularly investigate gravitational redshifts, because that to them seemed the most likely thing.
Right.
But... all these things had forbidden lines, you see. CC48 had had strong forbidden lines, which means that the density of the gas emitting the lines had to be very low, like 10 to the 4. And when you have a gravitational redshift, the linear size of the total thing must be very small,
right,
unless you have an incredibly large mass. M over R you want to be very large, and therefore R has to be very small. Therefore the emitting region is very small. Yes. But if the gas density in addition is small, you have a lousy radiator in the emission lines.
Right.
And there is no way to put it at a decent distance. So
so you eliminated that.
So Jesse and I discussed it at a quite early stage and managed to, well, in the first instance, dismiss it. And at a later time, I've rediscussed it, and it now looks even worse, essentially. Of course, the thing that has happened in the meantime is that some people have argued that the redshifts are not so much gravitational, but rather that they are simply non-cosmological. I mean, a number of people take the point of view that there is something at work that we don't know about yet, on.
But that came in somewhat later, though.
That came in somewhat later. That started around 66 a little bit, but much more so in 69 or 70 or so, by the work of Arp and Burbidge.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That's
You're very welcome.
Useful.
That ends the interview with Martin Schmidt on 18th August 75 at San Diego.